another reason I've always been interested in wonder, I talked about the birth of my child, I talked about reading literature, all these kind of positive things, but I've also been someone, I have struggled with anxiety and OCD through a lot of my life. I'm someone that can very easily get lost in my head and can struggle to be in the moment. And I've always been struck by experiences that pull me back in, yeah. Right? That's another reason why I think religion has been very important to me. It's right. A set of practices that pull me back into openness and openness to the world, openness to others, openness to God.
My friend Stephen Knepper is Associate Professor of English and Bruce C. Gottwald Jr. 81 Chair for Academic Excellence at Virginia Military Institute, or VMI. A scholar as well as a poet, Steve is the collaborative author of a book on the work of the South Korean philosopher Byung-Chul Han, the editor of a volume on the Irish philosopher William Desmond, and the sole author of the 2022 book on Desmond titled Wonder Strikes. Steve and I talk about wonder, about what it means to open ourselves to the world in an era of seeming constraint, and about the role of faith in the arts and in universities. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Steve, it's great to see you. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I've been a big fan of the show for quite a while, and it's introduced me to some great writers and thinkers. It's truly an honor to be here.
Thank you. Well, it's an honor for me to talk with you. You know, the people I invite onto the podcast usually have a couple things in common, right? They usually have some kind of writing or the kind of creative work I want to discuss with them, which is the case with you today, obviously. But second, they're people who inspire me and with whom I simply want to talk. And that's very much the case with you. And I'm just so enamored of so much of the work that you're doing. And so today we'll talk primarily about your work on the Irish philosopher William Desmond, and also your creation of a new online poetry review, which is very exciting for me as a reader of it. Mostly though, I want to talk with you about something I find compelling about all your work, all that I've seen of it, which is the openness and wonder that energizes it across its diversity. This is a great thing about the work you do, Steve. Perhaps I can begin by asking you to address one aspect of the diversity implicit in your job. You are an English professor at Virginia Military Institute, VMI. I know lots of folks who are English professors. I know others who are associated with the military. I don't know a lot of people who kind of have those paths cross. How'd that wind up being the case for you?
So VMI is a state military college in Virginia. It has about 60% of its students commissioned into the military upon graduation. The remaining 40%, some go into related fields and maybe intelligence or various government work. The rest go into just the normal fields that any college graduate might go into. All cadets, we call them cadets at VMI, all cadets do ROTC for all 4 years, whether they're going to do commission or not. And they all have to do core training throughout their cadetship. So it's a very unique school. They all live in a barracks. The conditions are pretty Spartan. During their freshman year, they have to go through kind of a strenuous training regimen. It's called the Rat Line. So it's a very unique place. I did graduate school up the road at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. So I've known about Virginia Military Institute for a while and had visited Lexington. I always admired it. And teaching here is a really unique experience. I don't have any military background myself, so I still feel like I'm still on the learning curve, even though I've been here for a decade now, figuring out all the acronyms and making my salute look respectable and all of these things. Still very much a work in progress. Some of the things I like about it is that, by and large, the student body is morally serious. They a lot of them are going to go and do very hard things, harder things than I've ever had to do in my life. And they want wisdom, and they want to be reflective. And I admire that. Another thing that's neat about VMI is that since the cadets have to do hard things in front of each other and often fail in front of each other, they're very intelligent, but there isn't a lot of ego in the classroom. They're very open. They ask questions. They change their mind. Conversation is just really great. probably the downside of that is they're really busy outside of the classroom. They have all these other commitments. So you can't assign as much reading as I think I could at another school. It's not a failing of the students and their intelligence. It's just time constraints. So it's a unique place. It's been a place that's grown me a lot as a professor. And yeah, I feel fortunate to work in kind of a mission-centered school. I mean, I think that's something for all their differences. I think that's something that VMI and a place like BYU has in common.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that as you were talking. And I really admire the qualities in the student and the cadets, I should say, that you were describing. BYU is not a military university, but it is a place with a lot of moral seriousness because of the mission of the university. And there's a lot of, I think, similarity there, like a Venn diagram, a lot of shared space between where you work and where I work. And if that one thing that I really appreciate about your work generally, it's why you're on this podcast, given this podcast's ecumenical and spiritual slant, is your openness to that kind of moral seriousness in the form of religion. And this is an openness that you expressed in your work through the subject matter you address and the influences that you cite and the conversation partners that you strike up. Let me ask you, you have a couple books out on William Desmond.
Sure.
One is an edited collection titled The Heart of Flesh, subtitled William Desmond and the Bible, published just last year, 2023. And the other is a monograph titled Wonder Strikes, subtitled Approaching Aesthetics and Literature with William Desmond, published in 2022. I'm curious how you learned about Desmond's work.
Yeah, so after I had that reconversion, return to religion in graduate school, I did what graduate students do, which is start reading lots of books. And I read a lot of figures that offer more kind of genealogical accounts. That was pretty important to me, figures like Charles Taylor, figures like John Milbank, and Desmond's name would pop up. And the first time I tried to read Desmond, he's a beautiful writer and so insightful, but he's not an easy writer. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to write my book, is that help people into this very rich philosopher who has kind of his own language and his own set of concepts. So the first time I encountered him, I was intrigued but didn't really know what to do with what I was reading. But then I actually happened upon one of his essays in an edited collection on wonder. I'd gotten interested in wonder. After grad school, I wrote a pretty conventional dissertation in American literature, kind of historicist, ecological thought emerging during the Great Depression in Southern literature. There's still things that I'm interested in. But I think too, as grad school went along, I was interested in, well, what draws us to reading literature, and what's sort of properly literary about literary studies? And this question of wonder, right? And wonder can be stirred by the natural world for sure. Wonder can be stirred in all kinds of ways. But I'd had pretty profound experiences of wonder and epiphany in reading along my life, throughout my life, from the time I was a little child right into grad school. Some of the times I think we can all think of literary works that the first time we read them, it just kind of blows us away, and we have these vivid memories of where we are and what that experience was like. So I was interested in wonder in literature and more broadly. My first daughter had been born around that time, so that's a wonder-inducing experience. And I encountered this essay on wonder by Desmond, and that was my in. That essay just really blew me away. And that's an essay that I still recommend that those new to Desmond start with, Ways of Wondering, which was gathered in his book, Intimate Strangeness of Being. He has a similar essay in The Voiding of Being, which came out a few years ago about wonder. But both of those essays just introduce a very nuanced account of wonder. And maybe in another question, I can sort of go into his different modes of wonder, but I'll leave it at that for right now.
That's great. I was going to ask you actually as a follow-up question about that, because you do write about Desmond's concepts, different modes of wonder a little bit, and I was wondering myself, whether you, because what in my experience of your work is that it's very open to things like wonder and very open to sort of the world and to beautiful things in it. And not just the beautiful things, but the it's like the layered, it's like the moral force of beautiful things or the beautiful dimension to a piece of writing that kind of bears somehow on practical life. There are things that seem to me to be kind of layered in your scholarship and the way you kind of just the world strikes you. And I'm wondering whether your experience of wonder seems mapped out or similar to Desmond's, or whether, you know, it's more that he's got a kind of wonder that he's talking about. It's not quite the same as how you identify wonder, but you kind of find kind of kinship in the fact that someone's writing about it the way that you tend to experience it yourself. It's a long way of asking the question, is wonder for you the same as it is for Desmond, or is he doing something different from how you take wonder to be?
I think that when I first read about Desmond, there was recognition. So it did provide me with a vocabulary to better talk about experiences that I had. But he also sort of stretched me in various ways. And I can talk a little bit about that for sure. One thing that I might add is that another reason I've always been interested in wonder, I talked about the birth of my child, I talked about reading literature, all these kind of positive things, but I've also been someone, I have struggled with anxiety and OCD through a lot of my life. I'm someone that can very easily get lost in my head and can struggle to be in the moment. And I've always been struck by experiences that pull me back in, yeah. Right? That's another reason why I think religion has been very important to me. It's right. A set of practices that pull me back into openness and openness to the world, openness to others, openness to God. So I think that Desmond's account of wonder starts with being struck by wonder. You can cultivate an openness to wonder, but you can't flip a light switch or force an experience of wonder. It's something that happens to you. And that in particular struck me as true and struck me as something that I had sought out. It's also worth saying that sometimes these are very pleasant experiences of beauty or a beautiful poem, but sometimes rattling experiences, tragic experiences can also bring that about. And I think that I attend and drawn to sort of both of those and have experienced both of those as a yeah, these experiences that break through our defenses or break through our habits and bring us back into openness. Or Desmond's term would be porosity. Yeah. Desmond, his description of the human being is that we are inherently porous creatures. At the most literal level of our skin and our sense organs, we're always in processing the world. We're always open to the world. But also in our souls, in our minds, you know, memories are often sparked by smells or things we see, right? They're unbidden memories. We're kind of porous all the way through. But we also are very good at sort of closing ourselves up, sort of clogging our porosity. I love the sort of grungy metaphor that Desmond uses for that. It you know, reminds me of like an acne commercial from my childhood.
I was going to say.
Clogged porosity. Yeah. He's like, and that's one of Desmond's great problems. You know, we often have clogged porosity and then we're less attentive. There's an ethical dimension to that. We're less attentive to others around us and we're less likely to be ethical, yeah. For sure. Yeah. But there's also kind of an existential dimension where we're more likely to be miserable when we're clogged up inside ourselves. So experiences of wonder sort of break us open in that way. And that's something that really drew me to Desmond's account.
Okay, this is great. That was really rich, Steve. Thank you. One thing you said, I want to pick up on here, but there are many things I want to pick up on that you said. But one thing I'll pick up on here, at least at the beginning, is you talked about how in some ways you yourself have found that it can be difficult always to be as open, as porous, right? Because if you do incline, as I do also, by the way, to kind of toward anxiety, you can kind of get lost in your own head, as you said.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder this question here. You know, our current era is an era, on the one hand, where there's so much presented to us about the world. We have access to so many images, to so much data. You know, you think about big telescopes kind of revealing new corners of the universe, which really just strike awe, you know, almost sure. Fear and trembling, you know, at the dimensions of space and what's out there. But it's also an era of tremendous anxiety, right? So on the one hand, we are, we use the word that Desmond uses, astonished constantly. At least there's potential for astonishment and perplexity, which is kind of like the negative wonder in a way. But it's also an error that can shut us down because of the things about which we are anxious, pessimistic, kind of polarized, not open to each other in the ways that maybe we would want to be. Do you see do you see Desmond, therefore, as someone who can speak to our age precisely because he thinks along with it as an age of wonder, or is he a corrective force for an era which is too little prone to open itself to wonder the way that perhaps we might?
Yeah. Oh, so much into that question. That's a great question. One of the first things I would say is that I do think that Desmond offers us practices that are sorely needed right now, contemplative practices, because you're right. It's not necessarily bad that we have these devices that allow us to do wonderful things like this, but there is such a thing as being so constantly washed in data and information that we lose that contemplative dimension, and we're not really open to us. It's just sort of kind of washing over us. It's buffeting us, but not necessarily reaching our depths in a way that opens us up. And it's also very easy to escape into screens and not attend to the real world or real people around us. So I'm very much in agreement with my friend Father Ryan Duns, who wrote a book about Desmond, Spiritual Exercises for a Secular Age, that Desmond offers us these practices of unclogging our porosity, these contemplative practices. And I do think that's an important corrective for our age. That said, I think that Desmond has not talked a lot about technology. He does more so in his more recent writings. And I feel like connecting those practices up to our moment is something that I register as a bit of a criticism of him at the end of the book. Criticism isn't the right word because, you know, he does so much and I'm so grateful for what he does. You know, it's silly to tell someone that is such a wide-ranging thinker, oh, but what about this too? I mean, I think that's not fair, but it's something that I think that is still necessary to sort of bring some of his insights to bear in a way that helps us today. It's also one of the reasons why, without sort of shifting the focus from Desmond too much, but just as an aside, one of the reasons I became interested in Byung-Chul Han, right, this philosopher who's very popular right now and very, very insightful about technology, and also has this contemplative dimension that he offers as corrective. Han is not nearly as systematic or as without taking anything away from him, as deep in sort of his metaphysical apparatus as Desmond is. But Han has a lot of insight into how technology can go wrong. And one of the things he points out is that it's very easy to feel like we're being open to the world when we're on our devices, but we're at the mercy of algorithms that are totally tailoring what's being shown to us, so that it's actually not the case, perhaps, that we're opening ourselves to otherness when we go on Twitter or on the internet. We're kind of trapped in the doppelganger algorithm feedback loop. So, you know, it can be a way of clogging porosity as well.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You're talking about Desmond in ways that are, I think, really insightful, not surprising given you've written so much and so well about Desmond. And also Byung-Chul Han, which I know you've got a book that your co-author coming out on Han here really soon, right?
Yeah.
These people you talk about, Steve, one of the things that makes me so grateful for your work is that you're either introducing me or educating me on these figures that I don't know as much about, but who seem to be so relevant precisely because they do speak to contemporary issues, but do so in the context of these contemplative practices that means so much to me, both intellectually and spiritually, religiously, right? So that it's an integrated way for me to sort of think about my own learning and my way of trying to be in the world. I want to ask you then about, just for a moment, kind of almost like a little sidetrack of the discussion of Desmond, about who you think you're writing for, you know, when you write about this, because clearly you're writing people like me. I'm so grateful for your work. But, You know, you said you were trained there at UVA, University of Virginia, which has got a top-tier English department, and they're really, really great. Are you writing for people like the professors who trained you, or is it that you found a different community in all the work you've done after grad school, right? Because, you know, one can spend a career writing to one's professors and in those circles, or one really can find new communities that one did not know existed when you were in grad school, the bubble of grad school. How do you, I guess I'm asking that, because almost that there are different tracks inside of literary studies, and I'm wondering whether you think that Desmond or Hahn and others are appreciated by both these tracks, or whether it's more that you've found different communities, that your post-grad school communities, that make more sense for these writers and these subjects.
Yeah, that's such a good question. And when you posed it to me by email, I've been thinking about that a lot. You'd think I would have a ready answer for it, and I'm not sure that I do. I had a wonderful grad school education, and I'm very grateful for my professors. But I do think that after grad school, I went in a different direction. And I think that certainly I had other audiences in mind. I think that I was interested in writing for philosophers of religion and Desmond students to make sure that they didn't lose the literary in Desmond, which is in the aesthetic, which is so important. Right. Not that they really were in danger of that, but the center of most scholarship about Desmond, and again, there are great exceptions. I could bring back Ryan Dunn's book. I mean, there's a lot of literature in there. But much of his scholarship is focused, understandably, on his philosophy of religion or his metaphysical account of being. But his own writing, so much of it is about art and aesthetics and literature. So I kind of wanted to make sure that that side of his work wasn't lost among scholars that are already interested in him or interested in adjacent conversations. I also thought about... I think that those of us that are interested in religion or contemplation as literary scholars, there are great journals devoted to that. Yeah. You published in them. But I also think that there's always more that needs to be done. And I think there's always a way in which it can be easy for a young literary scholar to read a lot of philosophers and theologians instead of reading people that are sort of bridging the gap or talking about, you know, literature. So, I mean, that was also another audience for sure. But then I think too, that another audience was kind of the post-critique crowd in literary studies.
Right. Yeah.
Students of say Rita Felsky.
Yeah.
I have no idea whether any of them will be, you know, will encounter this kind of niche book or not, but I'm grateful for a lot of that work. And I think that there is a real room for dialogue there between a more kind of post-secular conversation and this kind of post-critique. And for readers that don't know much about that, I might say that there's been an interest in literary studies in kind of paying more attention to things like the effect that literary texts have on us, how they stir wonder, not sort of just reading texts historically or sociologically, but being attentive to the ways that texts speak to us and that we shape them. And it's I think a pretty healthy conversation. So Rita Felsky, who I actually did not study with at UVA, missed opportunity. I think that grad school, for as great as it was, I think I didn't know how to get the most out of it until after I was through. I mean, maybe a lot of people feel that way, but I certainly felt that way. I think there's this is just a quick aside, apropos nothing, but that's one of the reasons why I encourage students to think about taking that gap year or a couple years before going back to grad school. I went straight in from undergrad, and I was raw, that is for sure. But Rita Felsky at UVA has written a lot of great things like this. Her book, Uses of Literature, which is pretty slim, but so chock full of good stuff, is a good thing to read there. But, you know, if I were to register a critique of Felsky, I think it would be something like, and she will say this, but she'll give a new term for something like mimesis or epiphany or wonder, and then saying, but yeah, of course, it's sort of like this thing's been talked about before, but it is the thing that's been talked about before. You know, it's kind of this return to a certain to use a kind of a word that's not that many literary scholars frown on. It's a return to a certain kind of humanistic approach to literary studies.
Yeah, right. We actually had Rita Felski out here at BYU. When I was the director of the Humanities Center, we invited her out here back in 2017, I think. And when she was a delightful guest, and she was also, I was part of an NEH workshop in Iowa with Laurie Branch and Mark Knight, two very thoughtful scholars of literature and religion and post-secularity. And Rita came out for the day there, and it was a good conversation partner. But there's been an effort to sort of want to involve her work in post-critique more in the studies of the post-secular, right? This kind of this interest in religious questions and religious experience in wonder at some level, right? That can open to us through an encounter with the arts, an encounter with the world, an encounter with literature. And it's such a, it, and it does speak, I think, to the hunger for this kind of work that really isn't so much about what she calls the limits. She calls this critique, you know, this certainty about things we need to find in the text that we read to sort of find out where they are wrong, or to find out, to reduce them to argument, and then kind of where the argument fails. It's a kind of a constant diagnosis of the ills of what we're encountering or reading. Rita says rightly that we're kind of exhausted with that. This is not. We're kind of, this has gotten very, very stale, and that what we're looking for are experiences of wonder, which is back to your work, which is why I think that your work on Desmond and on Hahn and others has been so beneficial to people like me who are trying to sort of figure out who the good conversation partners are, who think very rigorously about these things and can engage the serious tradition, right? But also help us to understand kind of how to respond in new ways to the world. But on that subject, let me ask you about Desmond then. As you point out, you know, he is a philosopher that engages in the arts and talks about religion and talks about, those three things are important for him, right? In conversation together, and he works kind of between them, as he points
Sure.
out, right? Between those three areas, philosophy, religion, and arts. He seems to me to be most at home in philosophy. A lot of the depth of his discussions are, I think, are especially resonant in philosophy. I'm wondering if you can explain for us why, as a very good philosopher, he felt he could not content himself with philosophy alone, why he felt compelled to take up also the arts and religion, to work between those three domains.
So, one angle on that question would be biographical. And at the beginning of his book, Perplexity and Ultimacy, he has a great little biographical essay. And he talks about how he started by studying, I think, engineering and math, and he was really good at that. But he sort of felt the call to the more humanistic approach. So then he switched over into literature and poetry, which is his first love. But he found that the kinds of big philosophical existential questions that the poetry often raises, the literature professors didn't want to talk about. And back then, I don't think it was negative critique that was the problem as much as probably a very kind of strict kind of formalism type of approach. So he ended up going over to philosophy. But always, I think, with that sense of being also a poet at heart, and he has a couple of books, God in the Between and Godsends, his most recent book, the chapters start with poems. And some of them are quite good poems, I think, at least. So he's always had that poetic side. But then also, some of his early work was on the figure of Hegel. And Hegel has this famously sort of elevates in terms of spirit, art, philosophy, and religion. Now, Hegel will ultimately give. Always dangerous to make claims about what Hegel ultimately does. There are Hegelians that will contest this. But in Desmond's account, and I think that he's on good footing by at least saying that this is a very valid interpretation of Hegel. Hegel's ultimately tips towards philosophy as sort of being the it can contain the insights of the other two in within itself. Desmond agrees philosophy, religion, and art are are main ways of grappling with the ultimate. They're kind of, they all three grow out of this experience of wonder, especially this wonder at why is there something rather than nothing? Why are there these things, right? And so in that way, they're kin. They grow out of the same roots. But Desmond would also say that they each have their legitimacy, and you can't just subsume one into the other, nor can you sort of silo them off. So this might be a good place to sort of come back to the discussion between post-critique and post-secular scholars. You know, if you're talking about something like the sublime, I think Desmond would say you're well within your rights to approach it from a more properly aesthetic, in the narrower sense, approach. You're well within your rights to approach it from a philosophical approach, but you're also well within your rights to approach it from a religious approach, because this is an experience of the too muchness of being. And no one gets to have the final word about that. And everyone has sort of, each of these approaches has something important to say about that experience. And so therefore, the conversation, each one is going to do a better job of giving an account if it's open to the voices of the others. Desmond is very critical of a philosophy that sees itself as only thought thinking itself, or thought thinking about thought. Right?
Right.
He's like, you know, philosophy needs to open itself to its others, and its most ancient others are art and religion. He too will tip his head towards one as sort of having pride of place, but not in a way that it subsumes the other, but in the way that it's sort of the most ancient. And that's for him is for religion. So even though he's a philosopher, he tips his head for religion as kind of the oldest grappling with the existential questions. And of course, you know, art and philosophy are sort of, you know, in within religion from the beginning, and then they kind of get separated out later on.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much for that. One provocative topic Steve addresses in his work is Desmond's claim that we once asked too much of art, with the result that today we ask too little of it. The idea goes something like this. When religion lost some of its explanatory force in the 19th century, you know, when emerging scientific paradigms challenged long-held religious ideas, some people began seeking answers to the meaning of our existence in art rather than in religion. This asked a lot of art, asked it to carry the weight of religion in accounting for the meaning of our lives. And while art certainly comments richly on the human condition, it also comments on itself as a human-made artifact, sometimes diverting our attention from large questions of meaning to questions concerning artistic or literary technique. In the 20th century, Desmond argues, such questions about technique became so prominent that we lost faith in art the same way we once lost faith in religion. As a result, we began asking too little of art, no longer believing it possessed the moral and soul-filling force people had sought from it in earlier generations. So, might we ask more from art? Should we? This is where I raise with Steve the question of contemporary religious poetry, poetry that is both beautiful but that also seeks to address large questions concerning the meaning of our existence and our relationship with the sacred. Let me ask you this. We're going to work here toward a little discussion of poetry as we kind of bend here toward conclusion in this conversation, Steve. There is so much great religious poetry being published right now, right? Many of these poets have been guests on this podcast. More will follow. I love reading their work. This is work of high aesthetic quality, high literary value, but also it's work that kind of is very, very thoughtful about these large questions about what our humanity means and what it means to seek a sense of ultimate meaning or purpose and what it means to encounter or wish to encounter or to, in memory, perhaps have encountered some aspect of the divine. Does a genre like that, religious poetry, particularly poetry written at such a high literary and aesthetic level, does that modify our sense that maybe too much or too little is asked of art? Because it seems like that kind of art is able to carry quite a bit of freight when it comes to, you know, kind of religious and social qualities.
Yeah. So one of the things I think I say in my chapter as kind of an aside, if not there, I've definitely written about it elsewhere. Something that struck me is that even in a time of declining religious affiliation, religious literature, serious religious literature, has had kind of an outsized influence, and so has ecological literature. And I quite enjoy both, and I think both are very important. Nature writing, religious writing, and often those things go together.
Yeah.
And I think that's because it's not making in any kind of like dogmatic way necessarily, but it's making a claim about reality as mysterious and worthy. And I think there's a hunger for that, right? So, I mean, in that way, it is sort of doing the proper thing, according to Desmond, which is it's a porous kind of artwork, right? It's not saying this is a self-contained, you know, painting or poem. This is a poem that has its own integrity, but opening out. It's a poem that's itself porous to something, or
yeah,
responding
good.
To something.
Yeah, to call this poetry porous, I think, is a great way to capture what I find so compelling about it, because it's not poetry it's beautiful poetry that is very much replicating the same kinds of poetic qualities that you associate with kind of this high aesthetic, you know, 20th and 21st century verse. But it's open to things beyond just the fact of its own poeticity. It's right, and I love that about that work. And you recently created this online journal of poetry titled New Verse Review. I don't know, Steve, how you get the energy to do all the things. I'm convinced you're actually a triplet, and there are three of you working all the time. But can you tell us about this new online journal and what motivated you to start it?
Yeah, so throughout grad school and even into my early teaching career, I was more of a novel and short story kind of guy, more of a narrative scholar. And I love narrative, but more and more, and I think it's partly because of that being drawn into the moment. It's that experience of wonder. And I think that often you get that more with poetry. But also I got interested in narrative in poetry. You know, Robert Frost is one of my favorite writers. And the way that good stories always have a lyric element, as B.H. Fairchild says. Mm. And I think that's true of novels, short stories, or poetry. And I became more interested in that charged lyric element in short stories too, and novels. So yeah, I became more interested in poetry. And I started trying to write some poetry. And it's a great time. There's lots of, you hear all kinds of things about poetry dying, poetry, you know, not having many readers, and I'm not saying there's a huge audience out there for poetry, but there's some really good poets right now. And I think that unfortunately it's become very hard for a lot of traditional journals to make it, and we've lost some really great traditional journals.
Yeah.
And I have no hubris about my journal kind of replacing something like a Gettysburg Review or a Holland's Critic or something like that. But you know, I thought I'm going to try to do sort of something outside of the normal institutional, you know, approach, and, you know, try to start a online poetry journal that's also starting a conversation, right? So I want it to be, you know, have a monthly link roundup that sort of, you know, starts building some community and builds across generations. And is especially, I'm interested in kind of formalist poetry, but then also a free verse too, that's musical, that's interested in shape. So, you know, those are things that, again, they're within the poetry world, that's just kind of a smaller world. So, trying to build a publication that'll help nourish poets in that space.
Which I think is fantastic. And I subscribe to the journal. It's an excellent resource, and it is very much community building, which I so appreciate, Steve. You are a great community builder inside of these fields about which I care, you know, kind of the place where, well, frankly, I'm back to this, where art or literature meets religion meets philosophy. I mean, if you're really good at connecting those networks in ways I'm very grateful for. So I'll leave you this question right here. You know, given how energetic you are in advocating for the arts and humanities, did you have a sense, you know, when you were leaving grad school, you'd be working on the people and subjects you currently are? I mean, do you have any intimation that this was kind of awaiting you? And if you did, do you have any sense now for the kinds of topics that may call to you 10 years from now? Are they similar, or do you sense kind of a sea change in the making in your own work, in your interests?
Yeah, such a good question. I mean, I don't think I saw this coming 10 years ago, these interests. I think, and still to this day, I have a little bit of imposter syndrome. You know, I'm a first generation college student. Grad school was not easy for me because I wasn't super well prepared. So you asked me earlier about the audiences for my Desmond book. I think another thing I would say there is that this was my attempt to try to figure out some of these questions for myself too. So I've always had this feeling that as much as I can, I wanted to sort of approach my writing and teaching as a pilgrimage or an intellectual adventure, or however you want to see it. And I don't mean that to be narrowly selfish, not at all, because I think that that kind of models for students what I think literature most has to offer, which is kind of a life transformative self-reflection, reflection on the world. So that's been kind of my approach. And I'm grateful for the universities. I'm grateful for colleges. But I'm also grateful for a growing kind of humanities conversation and a great growing poetry scene outside of colleges and universities. Yeah. And it's a hard time for colleges and universities, and especially for the humanities in them, for all kinds of reasons. So I do want to sort of speak to a broader audience more and more in my writing. In terms of where I'm going to go, I don't know. I mean, I feel very blessed to be able to do these kinds of things. I mean, you know, I go to teach and I think to myself, I get to teach, you know, Moby Dick today, or, you know, Robert Hayden today, or whoever it is, yeah. Right? And I know that this is going to really speak to a student, and I get to be there to sort of witness that and facilitate that. What a blessing, right?
It is.
So, I mean, I think I just want to see where that goes. I mean, I do have one project. I have no idea whether it has any legs or not, but I'd like to write some things about narrative and lyric as interrelated modes of living, right? The analogy between life and narrative has had a lot of very great scholarship. What about the analogy between life and lyric? You know, how can that help us understand something like a poem, for sure, but also the moments? We all have these moments in our life that are luminous for us, but, you know, we can't really say why they're important, but they're touchstones we come back to again and again and again. We may not tell anyone about them, right? What is that? We have our public story of our life, but then we have these chains of luminous moments, right, that are so meaningful. That kind of thing, right? What's the interaction between what poetry does and those kind of experiences? Or, you know, to triangulate back to your religion, you know, experience of worship, right? You know, it's sort of like this, it has this narrative dimension, but also has this lyric dimension. So I don't know whether that makes any sense, but that's something I've been thinking about too.
It does make sense to me. In fact, I got a class coming up, not today. I mean, coming up in 5 minutes. I mean, coming up, I'm teaching soon. I titled it Poetics of Faith. And it's precisely about kind of these, where lyric and life, you know, kind of touch on each other. And so you and I should keep this conversation going, because that's a conversation I'd like to know more about. And so maybe we could be good conversation partners in that. Steve, I'm so grateful for your work in so many ways, and for your time on the podcast today. And thank you for making so many good things more available to a scholar like me, or to interested readers who don't work at universities but who care about these kinds of issues. More power to you, and blessings to you in your work.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And likewise, I mean, your own work, and then this podcast, which is, of course, part of that work, it's a tremendous thing.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.